Call from mom. Answer it. Call silenced.
Instacart knows nothing gets between you and the game. That's why they make ordering from your couch easy. Stock up today and get all your groceries for the week delivered in as fast as 30 minutes without missing a minute of the game.
You have 47 new voicemails.
Download the app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcast. You'll be glad you did.
This is WTIC's Law Talk, a project of the Hartford County Bar Association. If you have a legal question, call now, 860-522-WTIC or 800-966-WTIC. And now, it's time for Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com.
Hi, everybody. Good afternoon, and welcome to an absolutely delightful Saturday afternoon here in Central Connecticut. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. For the next hour, my privilege to host these Saturday afternoon get-togethers. We're going to be discussing matters legal in nature. My guest I'm going to introduce in just a minute will be able to give you lots of information on some topics that are a little different than the ones we often talk about. They're a little bit controversial, but we think that people need to know about these things also. So first of all, let me tell you, we're going to be here until 4 o'clock. We welcome your phone calls with questions, with comments, and you reach us at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC. That's toll-free all over the continental U.S. And those numbers translate to 522-9842 or 1-800-966-9842. So if it's easier on your device to use numbers than letters, there you have it. Let me tell you about my guest. He is my friend, and he is just an excellent person to join us this Saturday afternoon. Attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz is the owner of Fasano & Tomasiewicz, a law firm in Hartford, Connecticut, and we are delighted to have Pat back with us again. He's a graduate of the University of Connecticut, Quinnipiac School of Law. His practice is devoted primarily to criminal and civil litigation, and that is both in the federal and in the state courts. And here comes the list of accomplishments. Honored as a Connecticut super lawyer for the last 13 consecutive years. Honored as a New England super lawyer for the last 12 consecutive years. Honored as a National Criminal Defense Lawyers Association top 10 attorney for the last 6 years. Certified by the National Board of Trial Advocacy as a trial advocate, recertified several times. He is very generous with his time for the profession. He is currently the president of the Hartford County Bar Association. He is licensed to practice both in Connecticut and in New York, and his professional memberships are numerous. They include the American Trial Lawyers Association. He's on the board of the Connecticut Trial Lawyers Association and is a member of the Connecticut Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. He has made numerous presentations and lectures to the profession on a number of different topics, and we are very fortunate to have him with us again today. Pat, welcome back to Law Talk.
John, it's a pleasure to be here. Good afternoon. Looking forward to working with you today.
Great, and I'm looking forward to it because you've brought some great topics with you. These are matters that are in the news. If we wanted to label it, we would probably label it Hot Topics in the Law 2020. So let me tell you a little bit about exactly what we're going to be doing here, and then we'll jump right to it. Remind you again that if you've got a question, or given the nature of the topics, if you've got a comment, or if you want to share an experience that you've had with us, our phone numbers here at the studio, 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. Okay, first up today, we're going to talk about the civil law regarding sexual assault. And this has a lot of different flavors, whether it's children, whether it's adults. Pat practices in this area. He knows this stuff, and we're going to separate out myths and misconceptions from the reality. We're going to talk about social media and blogging on the internet and things of this sort and defamation law. If you think that you've been defamed by somebody who's written something in a blog, in an internet post, whatever, you should listen. If you are concerned that something you've written may expose you to some liability, you'd better listen also. Finally, if we have time, we're going to get into some of the rather unique features of jury selection in Connecticut State Court. It is different. There are reasons for it, and we'll talk a little bit about those, and we'll welcome comments from any of you that have had experience with it to see what you think. So, Pat, we got our work cut out for us, and let's jump right to it. First topic up of the day, civil law regarding sexual harassment. Now, I said a few moments ago that it may be a little bit controversial. Well, the law deals with issues, many of which are controversial to some people, not to others. So let's start off, first of all, by seeing if we can put this into categories. Let's talk about, first of all, about sexual assault of children. Generally, where has this occurred? How has this played out? And tell us a little bit about the law regarding this.
Well, in Connecticut, on the civil side, there's a statute of limitations of 30 years after the age of majority to age 48 to bring a civil claim against a perpetrator or an institution. That statute was amended to age 51 last year, but it has a prospective operation to it, meaning that for those victims after the date of the enactment of the last statute last year, they have until age 51 to bring a claim. However, the legislature now is studying a complete eraser of the statute of limitations, and I think that's with the Judiciary Committee now. So this is a hot-button topic for the legislature and the citizens of our states, of our state, who have been victimized.
So let me ask you this, Pat. There are a lot of people listening who say, well, usually it's 2 years, it's 3 years for tort law. So now we're up to age 51 or 18 plus 30 years or whatever the current status of that is. Why is this treated so differently, and why has the legislature, so far as we know, chosen to extend this statute for such a long time? We have issues about memories fading and witnesses disappearing and all of the policy reasons why there are statutes of limitations in the first place. So tell us more.
Well, if you sit down with a victim, he'll give you the answer, or she'll give you the answer. You know, when a young child is sexually abused, it's accompanied by confusion, embarrassment, guilt.
Self-loathing.
Self-loathing, fear. The young victim, who's a child usually, 9, 10, 11, is so vulnerable, they repress it. They want to run from it. They don't want to vocalize it. And they're under a threat usually. Many times the MO is by the perpetrator. If you tell somebody, then you're never going to be able to leave this school. You'll never see your parents again. You know, I'll kill you. I'll kill your mother. And then after many, many, many years of repression, they reach an age where it's just haunting them so much that they come to grips with it, and they say, I need to do something. Now, one thing about sexual abuse, in my experience, in the vast majority of cases, the memories don't fade. The details are encrypted on the brain of the victim. The evidence can dissipate a little bit or a lot at times, and you have to reconstruct forensically what the evidence is. But because of these traits of the victim that I've described, there's oftentimes a delay of a significant nature established by literature, established by the American Psychiatric Association beyond debate, where the young victim waits until a later point in their life to do something about it.
Now, we're talking about not theories, but experiences which have been confirmed over and over as the law in this area has evolved and expert witness testimony has become more and more widespread. I just want our listeners to know before we take a break, which is what we're going to have to do in a moment, that this is not just some academic presentation. And while you may feel uncomfortable saying so, I will tell them that you have handled or are handling somewhere just south of 50 of these cases. So your experience is not just academic. It comes from right in the trenches.
I'm in the middle of it.
He's absolutely in the middle of it. And right now, we're going to have to take a break. But once again, we welcome you to participate. And if you've got a comment, if you've got an experience you want to share on this topic, we're delighted to hear from you at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-9842. You're listening to Law Talk on WTIC, News Talk 1080, and WTIC.com, streaming audio on the net. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. My guest today, Attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz of the law firm of Fasano and Tomasiewicz in Hartford. And we'll be back with more of Law Talk after this.
Time is really wasted. There's no guarantee. Smile is in the making.
Okay, welcome back to Law Talk right here on WTIC News Talk 1080. I'm Attorney John Matulis. My guest today, Attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz from the Hartford law firm of Fasano and Tomasiewicz. Topics du jour, civil law regarding sexual harassment. We're barely started on that. We're going to talk also about defamation as it unrolls in the internet age. So if you've got a concern about something that someone has written about you, or if you think that maybe somebody that you've written about may be doing something or not, stick around because our expert's going to tell you more about that and exactly what the situation is. Finally, if we get to it, we're going to talk about jury selection in Connecticut and why it's so unique and why it is different from just about every other state and what that means in practical, realistic terms. So, Pat, let's jump back to the sexual harassment business. The first category we're talking about was children. We've talked about why it is that the statute of limitations is so long. This has been an evolving area in the law. There have been thousands of claims literally against churches, the Boy Scouts, I understand, YMCA's school system. Do we see any sign of improvement of the underlying conditions that have led to this?
I think so. I think the litigation, there are two primary cases, Doe versus St. Francis Hospital and Doe versus Boy Scouts of America. So institutional settings, the hospital case involved an endocrinologist who serially abused over 100 victims in the 1970s.
And died a long time ago.
And died. And the evidence was found in his home of child pornography that was stored in a wall and covered over by plaster. And then the victims came forward. And then the Boy Scouts case involved a patrol leader on a scout member. The Boy Scouts have totally imposed institutional safeguards. Hospital settings, it's rare you have abuse. That was that wasn't even a one-off. That was just so incredibly aberrational. The church has now started to really clean house and really have strict safeguards. There's special training that any coach has to go through, any teacher Virtus training, it's called. It's a one-day program. It's a powerful program. I coach. I've been to the program. So, yeah, there's definitely an awakening of the consciousness and the responsibility that we have as a society toward children.
Let's talk about the St. Francis Hospital case as an example of what I'll refer to as enterprise liability or corporate liability. I don't think anybody could ever say with a straight face that the physician who was engaging in that child abuse was doing so with their encouragement or their acquiescence. So how is it that in that case, the institution is held responsible for what he did? In the case of the Boy Scouts, it's not the individual tortfeasor, if you will, the individual assailant, because many times they're of limited funds or may have passed on, but the institution of which they were a part. How do people make that jump? What's the legal theory that lets that happen?
Yeah. There's a doctrine in the law called respondeat superior. The employer is responsible for the misconduct of the employee. It's called torts of the employee. But with abusers, that law does not apply because that is outside of the course of employment. So there is a case which the St. Francis Hospital situation established, which is Doe versus St. Francis, which requires in pertinent part to impose liability upon an institution such as a hospital. The hospital must allow the creation of an environment where it raises or it's reasonably likely that the advent of sexual abuse will occur. We do not have to show in this state, unlike other states, that the hospital knew they had a predator on in their employ. It's a more liberal standard. If a hospital or another employment setting allows red flags, such as unsupervised access to children, in Doe, meetings, clandestine meetings, there where a supervisor of school is meeting at night with kids in a residential setting. In Doe versus St. Francis, you had photography equipment, film being purchased, these sort of aberrational purchases.
Camera was actually provided by the hospital under the belief he needed that for some kind of growth studies that he said he was conducting.
The front was these were growth studies of young males. Parents were encouraged to drop off and leave their young seven-year-old with Dr. Reardon, and then the hideous acts occurred. The location of Dr. Reardon's office was in a back section of the hospital. There were other factors to impose liability. It was just totally an unsupervised program. Mm. I don't even think he had a receptionist.
They just let him go wild.
Yeah, yeah. He had a gun that he wore at times when he was in the examining room, if memory serves, and I believe it does. So in that situation where it doesn't look right, it probably isn't right, and that's sort of a litmus test in a generic way on how to impose liability on an institution.
So that's how that all happened. If those of you out there were wondering, these actions obviously weren't approved of or anything, weren't part of the doctor's job description, obviously. But you create the environment where this stuff occurs and you may pick up liability for it. Let's shift gears to adults for a second.
Sure.
One of the phrases that I think was in the running for the most commonly used new phrase in 2019 was the Me Too movement. Mm-hmm. Basically the phrase to describe adult women, often in show business, who have come forward to complain of sexual abuse at the hands of individuals in various professions that apparently was viewed as a prerequisite for advancement. Can you spell Harvey Weinstein, for example, who is currently in the middle of jury selection in New York as we sit here? How does this play out in civil lawsuits? Do we have the same type of statute of limitations, the generous statute of limitations?
In Connecticut, we do, for sure. I won't comment on other states. I think New York now has no statute of limitations. I think the Archdiocese now and other churches in New York State have been opened up to litigation without a statute of limitations recently.
I knew there was a two-year window that opened, and there was a torrent of lawsuits by people that had been closed out by the previous statute but wanted to take advantage of that window while it was open.
I thank you for being more specific on it, John. There is a statute of limitations where the window was open. Thank you. But it plays out against adults a little differently because with an adult – oftentimes, if the adult is employed by an institution, then you have those same principles of liability. Mm-hmm. As long as the institution knows it's creating an environment where the likelihood of sexual abuse can occur, then the institution can be liable. People like Weinstein, he had a movie studio. He was insured. So the studio is a defendant in the civil litigation.
I think it went into bankruptcy.
Went into bankruptcy. I know there's insurance because I know counsel that's involved with that litigation. It's a local. It's one of our famous insurance companies in Hartford. We'll leave it at that. that's involved with the litigation. But oftentimes you'll have a situation where Weinstein, if there is an ideal situation in sexual abuse, he has assets. He worked for this movie studio. They were pushed into bankruptcy. Now there'll be a liquefaction of assets of that studio, movie rights, whatever it is. There's still going to be a dollar value.
Sure.
Oftentimes you have a lone perpetrator. It makes it more difficult with no employer. And then you're looking at assets.
Yeah. So that's a good overview on that. We're going to have to break for news and sports and weather shortly. So this is probably a good point for us to pause for a second. Let the listeners know that what you're listening to is Law Talk on WTIC News Talk 1080 and WTIC.com streaming audio on the net. If you happen to be away from Connecticut or if you've relocated, take us with you. Just click on the Listen Live button and that'll do it. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. Law Talk's going to return right after all of this good stuff. It does. That's what happens, folks. Okay, welcome back to Law Talk. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. My guest today, Attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz from the Hartford law firm of Fasano Tomasiewicz. And we're going over some topics that could probably be labeled hot issues in the law 2020. We're just going to finish up with a little bit more on the sexual abuse issues and the civil liability that has developed for not only the perpetrators, but also for the institutions that either employ them or which allow them to represent them. Then we'll talk a little bit more about internet defamation and possibly, if we get to it, jury selection. We're delighted to hear from you at 860-522-WTIC, 1-800-966-WTIC. But in the meantime, it is my opportunity to tell you that if you don't have an attorney and you need some legal assistance, there is a great program out there. The Hartford County Bar Association operates a not-for-profit lawyer referral service, and it is a great alternative to getting a lawyer from a billboard, from the internet, or from what some guy in the next bar stool says worked well for him, so to speak. Okay? This is the way it works. You call them on the phone at the number that I'm going to give you in just a moment, so you might want to have a pencil handy. They'll ask you a couple of questions to determine the nature of your legal issue. You then get referred to an attorney who practices in the proper discipline to handle your legal issue, is experienced, is insured, has been vetted, is free of disciplinary problems, okay? So what do you get and what does it cost? Two good questions. Here's what you get. Get a half-hour consult with the attorney and with no further obligation whatsoever. There's no hard sell at the end of that. If the half-hour finishes, no further service is requested, that's it and you're done. What does it all cost? Okay, there's a one-time only $35 fee to help underwrite some of the administrative expenses for running the program, office space, personnel, phones, that type of stuff. However, if you call them about your personal injury claim, they will waive the $35 fee. You got a Social Security disability claim? Call them up. They're going to waive that $35 fee. You've got a workers' compensation claim? Guess what? They're not going to charge you that fee either. Now, this is a good program. They have people that practice in a lot of different disciplines. How do you contact them? Okay, here's the number. The number is 860-525-6052. That's 860-525-6052. That is the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service. Now, we know that some of you are listening on the internet and you're saying, well, how can somebody in Hartford County help me out here where I am? Give them a call anyway. These models are built, these programs are built on a model from the American Bar Association. There's a number of them in the country. If you call them up, they can probably tell you if there's one near you and hook you up with that program. So once again, it's the Hartford County Bar Association's not-for-profit lawyer referral service at 860-525-6052. If you got a legal question, you don't have an attorney, give it a try. It is a good deal, and tell them Law Talk sent you. Okay, back to what we were talking about before. Pat, before we move on, let's finish up this topic of the sexual abuse issues. Somebody brings a lawsuit, whether it's against the predator, whether it's against the institution with which the predator is affiliated. This phrase, hedonic damages, comes up. Tell our audience a little bit about how these differ from damages you might have in a garden variety personal injury case. And then I want to know a little bit about how it is that when these cases get settled, how does the money get apportioned among all the different claimants?
Two types of damages in Connecticut: non-economic, economic damages. Economic damages are defined as lost wages, mainly loss of earning capacity, an ability to work.
Medical expenses.
Non-economic damages are quality of life damages. They're interchangeably referred as hedonic damages. In a sexual abuse setting, you can have both forms of damages, but mainly, oftentimes, you're going to run into non-economic damages. So there are all different aspects that are beyond the scope of a brief conversation about what kind of damages you can analyze in those cases. So depression, anxiety, alcoholism, drug abuse, drug dependency, re-perpetrating on another person.
So let me play devil's advocate for just a second here, okay? All of these things that you've mentioned, as unfortunate as they are things which occur regularly in life for people. So how do we know that it's due to the sexual abuse as opposed to something else, a problem with a spouse or a loved one or some other problem?
Well, you re-perpetrate on another person. It's next to impossible to show that should flow from a sexual abuse claim when you're a victim, because that's so criminal that all of us can't really take that into consideration. But you tie it to sexual abuse because it makes sense. You know, there can be post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD.
Well, we have some science on this now, right?
We have science on it. It's recognized by the American Psychiatric Association. People, you know, they have recurrent dreams. The recurrent dreams can make them depressed, anxious, sorrowful, angry, and it in a nutshell, to synopsize, it just makes sense, because usually you're looking at the underlying abuse. It's not one episodic situation that lasts 10
it's
in
chronic.
Situations where someone is, you know, time after time abused over a period of 6 months, it just destroys the soul. So many people have climbed out and they deal with it and they have families and they go to work, and many people haven't. And when those that haven't, they've been just afflicted by the pain of it. And it's the most painful tort that you can impose upon a young person, short of death, imaginable.
Well,
it just ties together, John.
Pretty powerful indeed. And there's been quite a bit of experience with juries now, especially in Doe versus St. Francis Hospital. So we've had an opportunity to see what the general public, sitting as jurors, think about the scientific evidence that ties this type of abuse to the damages that have been displayed. Let me ask you one more question about this, okay? There's a claim against a particular institution. Take a church, for example, okay? And we've got X number of plaintiffs, 200 plaintiffs, just to make an example. Maybe the church's insurance coverage stops at a certain point. There's X dollars that's available. And the church says, well, we're going to settle this. We want to get this over and settled and help to address their misery by settling the case. How do the lawyers involved apportion out what resources are available or what funds are available for settlement among all these different claimants who I assume have differing degrees, differing levels of severity of the damages they've suffered?
Usually categories of claimants are established. So you will have category number one, which will involve claimants that have been exposed to sexually inappropriate behavior. We'll call it petting.
Okay.
Touching,
or fondling.
Fondling,
yeah.
The exterior of the clothing. Two, the second group will be more invasive sexual abuse. And then the worst category, you know, we'll call it category three cases. that's where there are – that involves the most heinous forms of sexual abuse. Once you set up those categories, then you are liquefying compensation to those categories. The first category will have a range of compensation from $0 to a certain amount. Second category will have a higher range of compensation. And then the third category will be a much higher seven-figure range of compensation.
So this can all be put on a spreadsheet almost, and then you can factor in frequency of abuse or duration of abuse and how it is that it's affected the person.
Yeah, and the third category where I suggested a seven-figure range can be modified depending on the amount of dollars that the entity is paying. Some entities have many layers of insurance. Others do not. Some entities have more assets that they're willing to liquefy than others. It depends what's in the aggregate amount that you collect.
Yep. And if I understand correctly, there have been some dioceses, especially in California, that have sought relief in the bankruptcy courts.
Mexico, California, Minnesota, Canada. They have gone to the bankruptcy court, and then that's a whole different scenario.
Pat, you've given us an excellent overview of a controversial situation. It's something that
I meant to say New Mexico, John. If I said Mexico, New
Mexico.
Mexico, right.
Yeah. But we're going to have to take a break in just a moment. I think that's a great overview of this situation. It's an unfortunate thing that it's ever occurred, but it has. The situation is being dealt with by the legal system. And now, thanks to my guest, Attorney Pat Tomasiewicz from the Hartford Law Firm of Fasano and Tomasiewicz, we had a little bit look at how the judicial system has dealt with this. We'll be back with more of Law Talk. I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association, and we'll be back shortly.
Please don't worry.
All right. Well, that bounces us right back to our last section of Law Talk today. Thanks to Mike Olko for that piece about don't worry about no jury. That's exactly what we're going to be talking about. Who is we? I'm Attorney John Matulis from the Hartford County Bar Association. My guest, Attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz from the Hartford Law Firm of Fasano Tomasiewicz. Pat, jury selection. A lot of listeners may not realize, but Connecticut is a little bit unique. If John sues Jane in Connecticut, and they're picking the jury at 450 Main Street, it's going to be dramatically different than if they're picking the jury three blocks away at 95 Washington Street. Is that true? And tell us why that is. How it's going to be different, too.
Well, in our state constitution, we have Article 1, Section 19. It's established that we have a right to individually question jurors, and that's called voir dire, which is French for to hear and to speak.
Now, my French teacher would have insisted we call it voir dire.
Voir dire. Which it,
talk to a Southern lawyer and see what you get.
Voir dire is what you get from the South.
You're all right there.
And what it means is you can meet with jurors. You can sit with a juror. You can question a juror nicely for 10 or so minutes and try to find out if they have any individual biases against, if it's a civil case against compensating someone, against the lawyer who's brought a suit against a doctor or a negligent driver, against the jury system in general, whether they've had any prior experiences where they've been hurt or sat on a jury. You learn a lot because you can get a juror with its own agenda, his or her own agenda that can completely taint a jury. Same in criminal cases. We have individual jury selection. Do you believe in the presumption of innocence? Well, you know, the defendant over here has been arrested. Does that affect your opinion as to whether you can presume he or she to be innocent unless until the state proves otherwise? These questions are a great way to gather information. Federally, it's different. Everybody comes out at once. It's called box voir dire. The judge asks most of the questions. The questions are submitted in advance. The jurors raise hands individually. You'll have 40 people in a box.
In front of all of the rest of them there.
In front of all the rest of them there. Jury selection lasts about 5 hours, and you can pick eight jurors. And lawyers will be allowed to ask questions, but it's different.
Instead very few.
Very few. You can ask, sometimes a judge will say, you know, does either counsel want to ask questions? And in that situation, you'll find lawyers saying, you know, how many of you think, you know, how many of you think that you should be able to bring a claim for personal injuries? Usually that's but any other questions, how many of you are opposed to, and whatever the problem is in the case or what you're trying to get the jury to endorse, somebody raises their hand, you get them to talk, and then you say, well, how many else, does anybody else feel the same way? So you try to tease out those biases. There's this whole trend now, John, which you're going to come upon to eliminate individual voir dire, as you know, in
the
state
of Connecticut. And we'll talk about that shortly. So one of the things that I wanted to mention was why it is that this conversation with the individual jurors, which takes place in state court, is so important. And you've hit upon it. It gives you information or insight into whether they may have a bias one way or the other. Because regardless of what anybody thinks about a specific case, everybody in the system pretty much adheres to the belief that we want a jury that's going to be fair and give both sides the opportunity to be treated fairly and listen to the evidence. Now, one of the things I'm going to ask you about, I think as time has gone on, and especially as people have seen more and more television programs involving the legal system or law programs, that I think the jurors realize that there are certain questions that are designed to elicit their opinions or their views, and that they're not necessarily going to be completely candid or straightforward in their responses, because they sort of see that, well, if I really say that I don't think the Senate ought to have an impeachment trial at all, they ought to just go ahead and, you know, exonerate the guy. For example, that's probably not going to be received as well as, well, I'll listen to both sides fairly. So do you find that sometimes there's sort of a suspicion that maybe the jurors aren't being completely forthcoming with the answers from counsel?
Sure. I mean, that's...
How do you deal with that?
By instinct. Only by instinct. Mm. Something doesn't feel right. It could be... It's just the body language. It's the way the arms are folded. It's the eye movement. Whatever it is, it's the inflection of the speech. But that's your main concern, is trying to find a jury. You're being as direct as you possibly can with them, hoping that you can say, listen, we just want it to be a fair process. So if there's something here that makes you uncomfortable, don't worry. Just tell us, because you could be suited for another jury. You could sit on another case. This one might not be right for you. You try to get an agreement that they'll be as open with them as you're trying to be with, as open with you as you're trying to be with them. But it's a dice roll, John, as you know.
Oh boy, is it?
There's uncertainty about the process. There's a whole industry out there of jury consultant experts. They will sit there with you, Lisa Blue, David Ball, Eric Oliver. They'll sit with you in court, and they will just say, "This is somebody you don't want. This is somebody that you do want." So, in that situation, you're basically a psychologist with a law degree when you're picking a jury. It's tough. It's fun. It's rewarding.
Unlike television, especially Bull, we don't know an awful lot about a prospective juror before we sit down and talk with them, do we?
We don't know anything. We get an informational form that says,
"Are you related to an attorney or a police officer?
Police officer. How far did you go to school? You know, where do you work?
Are you ever been married? Convicted of a crime?
Ever been convicted of a crime? It all we have is this little form, and we take it from there, and it's." It's a lot of fun, but it's a risk, big risk section of the case, because if you get the wrong juror, your case is in trouble. You're hung.
There was a time, and especially when I was starting to practice, where jury selection, especially the individual jury selection, was viewed as an opportunity to try to indoctrinate the jurors to understand the case in the way that you wanted them to understand that. But my sense is that we've gotten quite a bit away from that now. And if we do that at all, it's in a much more subtle and less perceptible fashion. What do you think?
I think that 93% of cases settle, 92% of them. You know, a federal judge wrote an article about the jury trial as a vanishing act. I think that was Judge Kravitz. So I still think that plaintiff's lawyers and defense lawyers get training on how to indoctrinate, but it's done in a more subtle and nuanced fashion, but it's I think it's alive and well. You know, for example, do you think somebody just who brought a claim, you know, is entitled to compensation? Do you think just because they're here with a lawyer, those questions are still going?
Oh yeah,
right? Yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that you would stick to your guns and not succumb to the pressure of other people in the jury that might have been swayed by something that you didn't think persuasive? You know, a lot of those there. We've talked a lot about the advantages of individual voir dire. Let's just tell our listeners about some of the disadvantages.
It's time consuming.
Oh, yeah.
It can be 3 to 5 days. I mean, I picked a jury in a very serious felony case. You know, it went 4 weeks. I mean, we had in that case get 12 jurors, and because of it was a Class A felony, the questioning was lengthy. So it's time consuming. Your client usually doesn't like it, and there are other reasons.
Sure, and some of us that are paid by the hour for what we do, the difference between a 4-hour federal court jury selection, 6 jurors, 2 alternates, versus a day and a half, 2 days minimum in a civil case, that's a lot. You know, that's a fourth of the fee just for jury selection.
Sure.
But that music is my clue that yet another Law Talk has come to a conclusion, and we'll be finishing up shortly. So I'd like to thank all of you for listening. Thanks to the radio station for giving us this opportunity to share some thoughts and some information. Thanks especially to my guest, attorney Patrick Tomasiewicz from the law firm of Fasano Tomasiewicz in Hartford. He's taken his afternoon off to help us to understand some of these concepts, and we thank him very much for that.
Thanks, John. It was an honor to be here.
Glad to have you, Pat. Thanks also to Mike Oko. He is the guy who is tasked with the unenviable job of trying to make us sound good. So, Mike, thank you very much, and until next week.
Law Talk is presented as a public service by the Hartford County Bar Association. Its content is intended to be educational and informative, but is not considered to be formal legal opinion. If you want or need a formal legal opinion upon which to rely in decision-making, please consider formally engaging an attorney to review all relevant facts in detail and examine the pertinent law as it applies to those facts. A solid opinion means better decisions. The views expressed during this program are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Hartford County Bar Association, its officers, or its directors.